Road to Cooperstown podcast with John Morosi is really cool. Fox Sports, John is on, and the MLB Network does a great job. Podcast part of the MLB Network channel in collaboration with SiriusXM, where he talks about Hall of Famers and talks to Hall of Famers. And chatted with Wade Boggs, obviously the legendary Red Sox, legendary Yankee. Boggs tells the story of how he came to sign with the Yankees during George Steinbrenner's suspension years.
Mrs. Yawkey was still alive. She says, Wade, I want you to be a Red Sox player for life. The beginning of January, she slips and falls in a tub and dies. I go to spring training in 92. They take the offer off the table. First team to call are the Dodgers. The next morning, the Yankees call. We sit down, have a conversation. Joe Malloy goes, would 3 years, $11 million put you in pinstripes? I said, I think you got a new player that's going to put pinstripes on. And there's a gentleman sitting at a table over here reading a newspaper, and a newspaper comes down, and it's George, and he winks at me. And he was listening to the whole conversation.
There you have it. I love that story. I love getting those backstories, and John joins us now. Hey, John, Mark Malusa is with you. Thanks for the time this afternoon.
Moose, I am outstanding, and I smile every time I hear Wade's story because I did not know that, obviously, and so to know that George Steinbrenner, as if it's a movie scene, is sitting at the next table and then the newspaper comes down. One of my favorite stories, Moose, that I've heard while doing the Road to Cooperstown podcast.
Yeah, it's great. And John, listen, I love the backstories. First off, you appreciate the players for their greatness and what they were able to accomplish, but everything that goes along with it, whether it be the big games, Boggs leaving in free agency, signing with the Yankees, obviously the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry. I love this series on the podcast because not only you learn a little something, but you hear stories you never heard before.
Well, Moose, you're exactly right. And one of my favorite lines on interviewing, and I wish I remembered who said it first, but the line is this: it is amazing what people will tell you when they know how the story ends. And that means basically that once you've got a player who's already in Cooperstown, they're not going to take the plaque away. Okay, so the stories are what they are. And now that a player knows where he is for all of baseball immortality, you get some different things than if it's a post-game interview at Citi Field or Yankee Stadium on a Tuesday night in May. It's different. And I've heard some pretty remarkable stories. I've had people like Larry Walker, someone who you would not expect to break down in tears because you really get a sense, Moose, for how much Cooperstown means to them. And I really believe the more years that go on, and you just think about the arc of a life story and players who then get to their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, they think less about the plaque and the numbers and more about the relationships. And one of the things that I've heard from multiple Hall of Famers, Moose, is that on your first induction, it's Johnny Bench who sits you down on the veranda of the Otisaga there and overlooking Lake Otsego there in Cooperstown and tells the new Hall of Famers to sit down, pause, and look around this beautiful lake and all the people around you, the immortals of the game. And I come to believe, Moose, just from talking to a lot of these players, it's those moments, it's Johnny Bench telling you to sit down and take it all in, that matters even more than the numbers themselves.
I'm sure it does. I mean, that's really cool. John, I want to ask you about Boggs here. You know, 86, the heartbreak with the Red Sox. And, you know, I was in the building in 96 with my older sister, Kim, watching Wade on the horse, the police horse, right. You know, on the field at Yankee Stadium after they knocked off the Braves in game 6. What about that, you know, that 10, 11 years here, what he wasn't able to accomplish in Boston and what he ultimately accomplished here in New York with the Yankees?
You know, Moose, it's a great question. It's one of the stories that stood out to me the most about Boggs. And there's this image, if you're a Red Sox fan or Met fan, certainly a lot of Yankee fans watch the 86 series carefully. There's this indelible image of Boggs in tears in the dugout after the Red Sox lost Game 7. A Game 7 that, by the way, despite all that happened in Game 6, they still led early in that game. And so they end up losing Game 7. And what Wade told me, Moose, that really stood out to me is that the reason why he was so overcome with emotion, yes, he was devastated to have lost Game 7 of the World Series after coming so close in Game 6, but his mother had died in an automobile accident earlier that year. And Wade told me that he had basically bottled up that sense of grief of losing his mom in the middle of the season because there was always one more game to play. And he just packed in that grief and that emotion and heartbreak every day because, okay, I've got 9 innings tomorrow. I've got to get 2 or 3 hits. And it just kept going and going and going until all of a sudden there was no more game to play. And wow. that was what Wade said, that it hit him that not only had he lost a baseball game, but on a much more important human level, he had lost his mom. And he was then finally confronted with the grief of that he had just kind of tucked away inside of himself for all those months. And it was one of the more emotional moments I've heard someone talk about during the course of the podcast. And then to fast forward 10 years, more tears at a different ballpark in New York, only this time, as you're describing, Moose, you saw it with your own eyes, he's on the back of the horse, and he's finally a World Series champion, and he's crying again in a very different way a decade later. So just growing up as he was the son of a military man that moved around so much, Tampa became home. He had these different chapters of his story, but I think it was that discipline and the way that he was able to approach the game that ultimately led him to that 96 World Series, even though, Moose, as you remember well, he had lost playing time in that series. They lost the first 2 games, but it was that pinch hit walk. You remember in game 3 in Atlanta that changed the whole series around. And so even though his role had been diminished, I believe firmly, and you probably do too, the Yankees do not win that World Series without him coming off the bench, drawing a walk, and turning the whole series around there in game 3 in Atlanta.
No, and John, in today's day and age, you know, I really have a deep appreciation of watching Boggs, you know, because the batting average, because in today's day and age, nobody cares about batting average anymore. And when I watched Boggs, all it was about batting average. He was an unbelievable, his approach at the plate and watching him day in and day out, whether it was with Boston or whether in New York here with the Yankees or Tampa, you know, deserve it, obviously, Hall of Fame and immortal and all-time great, but his approach at the plate was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. And it was interesting, Moose, to hear Boggs describe this. His approach at the plate was inextricably linked to all those superstitions. Now, he gave me the estimate. He said that when he was going through his career, that he had more than 80 superstitions that he did a day. More than 80.
That's insane.
Now, it is. And he admits and acknowledges that it was his own way, and he fully agrees and understands there was a lot of compulsions, mental compulsions that were all part of it. But he said the goal of all of those compulsions, if you can believe it, was to basically tire himself out mentally such that once he got in the batter's box, he was so exhausted from all the superstitions and his brain was just blank. Now think about that. In contrast that with a modern player. You've got iPads everywhere. We are awash in data, information, launch angles, swing mechanics, degrees of openness of your stance, and bat path and everything else. Wade Boggs told me, Moose, the whole goal for him was to basically be completely mentally worn down from all the, you know, tracing the chi in the dirt and all the different things he did, the chicken and everything else. It was the goal of having his mind be completely vacant. Can you believe that?
I can't believe that.
Now we're in the total opposite world. It's like the exact polar opposite. You've got to have as much information as possible. I don't know to the modern players. Granted, I was not a very good player myself. But all I know is this. The dude with the highest batting average of any player alive, retired or active, his goal was
to exhaust himself mentally before he stepped in the batter's box.
Exactly. Was to think nothing, see ball, hit ball. That was his goal. I don't know, everybody. It worked for him, and it worked for George Brett, and so maybe they're onto something. But again, Mark, I'm going to say that, and someone's going to say to me on Twitter today, "Hey, man, what do Wade Boggs and George Brett know about hitting?" I don't know, guys. Check the numbers.
Yeah, they were pretty good. John, one more on Boggs. I want to get your thoughts on the sure. Mets and the Yankees. Is which team? What team did Boggs say was the best team he was ever on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't remember the exact phraseology that it gave me, but when you consider the way that Yankee team came together later on in his career, I think he saw this the different constellation of stars be really special, but also that 86 team. You look at how many Hall of Famers or could have been Hall of Famers when you think about Clemens as well, and even someone like a Dwight Evans. I mean, he played on some significant teams, and I think it's I credit Wade for this, Moose, that he's able to, I think, have the Red Sox part of his legacy and the Yankees part of his legacy coexist in a way that I feel like, and you would know this better as a New Yorker, I think he is able to have those two things cohere and exist, coexist in a way that I think for Clemens it's been hard, and for Damon it's been hard. I think Boggs in a certain way is able to make it work, and maybe it's because Red Sox fans understand the story that you heard him tell about Mrs. Yawkey wanting him to be a Red Sox for life, but then she passes away and it doesn't happen. I think they understand that it really wasn't his fault as to why he didn't return to Boston.
We're talking to John Morosi. Check out the new podcast, or the podcast Road to Cooperstown. It's in conjunction with MLB Network Channel and also SiriusXM. It's fantastic. And talking about the Boggs, the latest one with Wade Boggs. John, I want to ask you about the Mets and the Yankees here.
Sure.
You look at Nolan McClain. I mean, he's been, downright brilliant in his three starts. Jonah Tong tonight. When you look at this Met team, five games in back of the Philadelphia Phillies in the National League East, I've talked about they're a dangerous team if they're able to find that magic from a year ago. What's your take on the Mets right now?
Really interesting. And I think that when you consider McClain and Tong coming up this late in the game, I think it's a misconception that you've got to have all this experience to be able to win. Because at some point in time, obviously, you think about the 96 Yankees, Jeter was a very young player. Just to use one example, and even the 86 Mets that we talked about before, it's always someone's first time. And if this team gets going, and the big question is if Tong is dominant, and again, we haven't even seen him pitch yet, so who knows exactly how it's going to all play out. But McClain certainly has been. He is very clearly the real deal, which I think in a lot of ways probably gives Met fans the confidence that, hey, we're developing pitchers the right way, and by the time they get to Flushing, they're ready to pitch and perform. I fully expect the Mets to be the second-place team in the division. I think they'll win a wild card. They'll hold off the Reds. I was just in Philly last night for Schwarber's four-homer game. I don't think that team's going to totally collapse, even though I do have some worries about their pitching without Wheeler. The Mets, I look at as being a very dangerous team in the wild card round to be able to get through there. And then at that point, trust these kids. If they show you that they can perform, I don't know how much more of a pressurized environment McClain would feel. And the playoffs, as we know, are a different level. But he comes up and faces the Mariners, a good playoff team in the American League, at a time where the Mets rotation is begging for some consistency. And he just deals. So he's proven his mettle in a pennant race in New York. The playoffs are a different octave, but I look at McClain, especially based on what we've seen, he is not a guy that's going to be afraid of the big stage, Moose. I feel as confident as I could feel in a rookie pitching in the playoffs. That's how I feel about Nolan McClain.
Yeah, and you were in the building last night. You saw the Phillies take out their frustration, John, on the Atlanta Braves and Schwarber with the four home runs. But there is no doubt. I mean, when they go to Queens, they're a different baseball team. I mean, that was an impressive sweep by the New York Mets. Without Wheeler in that starting rotation, you don't think they're going to collapse, but how dangerous do you think this Philadelphia team will be?
Well, I think they're going to have to win games a little bit differently than they had expected. Again, Wheeler, it's hard to underscore how big of a loss that is. I mean, it's a Cy Young candidate. He's a pitcher for them often. You know, Nola showed last night, he was a little wobbly in the first inning. He almost had to leave the game early, but was able to stabilize. And they're heavily dependent on their lefties, okay? Sanchez, Suarez, and Lusardo. So if you get a team, and in that way, you think about the Mets, especially with Alonso, this is a team that can do some damage against left-handed pitching, I still think, in the course of a playoff series, to where if the Phillies run up against a team with serious right-handed power, they could be in trouble. Now, their bullpen has been stabilized a bit. By the way, David Robertson is again found the fountain of youth.
Crazy.
Rob Thompson said, Rob Thompson told me yesterday, he said, Robertson's in better shape now than when he debuted as a rookie with the Yankees in 2008. He can just keep doing it. I said hello to David yesterday, big smile on his face. And the joke, of course, is, hey, if you only got to work a half season a year, feeling great. You still, you know, play half a season, show up, go to the playoffs, and you're in a great, great frame of mind. So he's been really good. Duran, obviously, is excellent as a back in the game, too. So they're definitely not the scary team that I thought they would be. And I do think, as much as I love the Phillies lineup, there's opportunity there. There's opportunity for a team like the Padres with that amazing bullpen. There's opportunity for the Mets. And I think you saw, as sort of wobbly as the bullpen looked right after the trade deadline with Helsley, that will find its level eventually. And I feel as strongly about the Mets' chances of making a run in October than I do, maybe even more so than I do about the Yankees. I just think that the Mets, I have a little better sense of what they're all about. And if you're able to sweep the Phillies at home at this time of year, it says a lot about where you're at as a ball club.
Yeah, John, you stole the next one, you know, and I want to get your thoughts on the Yankees before we let you go. And that is, you know, they beat up on the Nats. Do I learn anything? No. They beat up on the White Sox last night. They hit a ton of home runs. Have I learned anything? Not necessarily. Like, I think the next 12 games after this White Sox series, when they're playing, you know, upper echelon teams, if you can call it that, in the American League, you're going to learn a little something before the soft landing spot at the end of the season for the New York Yankees. Get concerned about this Yankee team, John, when you look at it in terms of the sloppiness in the field, sloppiness in the base pass, whether or not they can generate offense, if they can't generate the home run. What's your take overall on this Yankee team? Freed's been better last two starts. Rodon's been good. Schlittler's been good. Back into the bullpen, getting the ball, obviously, to their closer has been an issue at times. What's your take on where the Yankees are right now?
Yeah, and you mentioned a name in Schlittler who I think has been underrated nationally a bit for how good he's been. I think Bednar, since his first appearance, has really stabilized well. Here's the question I've got. Actually, I've got two questions with this team. Number one, unlike last year, when you had Soto, who was like at the peak of his powers, there one of the reasons why this team made the World Series last year is that pitchers, I think, were in a bit of a panic as to who they could attack, who they had to pitch around, because you couldn't pitch around all of Soto, Stanton, and Judge all the time. Couldn't do that. And I wonder, is there anybody in the lineup, and maybe it's Stanton, we'll see how it all plays out based on who's able to, you know, can Judge play in the field, etc. Who is there that's going to be able to attract enough attention from the other teams such that Aaron Judge sees any pitches to hit? That to me is different than last year. Soto was, yeah, the right-left balance, et cetera. There was a team that could say, listen, we're either not going to let Soto beat us or we're not going to let Judge beat us. I just wonder, and we saw Judge at times just not see pitches to hit. He didn't have a great series against the Royals. And even the Guardians, it was still hit and miss. I just wonder, when you look at Judge, how many pitches he is going to see to hit. And also, like last night, they were able to overcome the defensive miscue early on from Volpe.
Yep.
But you can't do that against good teams.
No, you can't.
If you give good teams extra outs, they will beat you. And I think my big picture point, Moose, on the AL and NL sides right now, I've been fortunate to cover this great game for about 20 years. I have never seen a postseason that is this wide open. I love this game. I cover it every day. I got no idea what's going to happen, and that's a good thing, okay? It's good to have unexpected, and that's where if someone says, hey, John, the World Series is going to be Milwaukee against Seattle, that guess is as good as mine because I have no idea what's going to happen, and if the Yankees get knocked out in their first round, that could happen. They could be back in the World Series. It's a different group. There's no Garrett Cole like there was last year, but Fried's been better, to your point. So it's almost like day-to-day, and I love this about baseball. You can almost convince yourself that this team is going to figure it out, and then the next day they lose 9-2, and you're like, oh my gosh, it's going to happen. That's why I think we're in such an unexpected spot with Major League Baseball right now.
John Morosi, Fox Sports MLB Network. Check out his podcast, The Road to Cooperstown Podcast. It's a fantastic listen for any baseball fan. Hey, John, appreciate the time this afternoon. Have a great Labor Day weekend, all right?
Moose, you do a great job on the show. I'm honored to be on it with you here, and have a great and safe holiday weekend as well.
You got it. Always good to talk a little bit of baseball, and he talks about the wide-open nature of Major League Baseball. We'll touch upon that as well.